We have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
Well,
gosh, we're both here at the same time. This is very exciting.
You are, and we have the bulk of the votes in, so we can tell people what the heck happened.
The restraining orders are off now, and it's great. So I should mention that that I'm free to talk about local politics again because I'm not running a mayoral campaign because the person I was working for, Joey Gray, did not survive the primary. I've been doing some consulting. Previously off the books, but it's now official for Shama Sawant, who's did survive the primary and is running for city council. So just that disclosure and the usual caveat that nothing I'm saying here or in print for Eat the State or the newspaper columns or whatnot is a reflection on any campaign that I'm working for. The nice thing about working for Shama, though, is that I can say just about anything on the air, and it's not going to bring discredit on the campaign because they're totally focused on what she's saying, which is in many cases more radical than what I would say. So I can kind of talk freely about that now, and I can, boy, if I wanted to say things about the mayor's race for the last 3 months, and I haven't been able to. But we did get McGinn and Murray in the highest profile of the races as surviving and going on to the general. There were four major candidates, less major candidates, I guess, would be the way to say it. Of the four majors, they all had advantages and they all had flaws. And unfortunately, I think in many ways the two, well, I shouldn't say the two most flawed because all of them had serious flaws. But McGinn and Murray, you know, in a campaign that has been dominated really by talk about civility and working together and getting things done, you got the two people who are least skilled at working with other people and getting things done and not being bullies, because they are, in fact, both have reputation for bullies. Those were the guys that survived. Ed Murray has a reputation, you know, for all the good that he has done in Olympia, he also has a reputation for being very abrasive with colleagues and burning a lot of those bridges. He has a reputation for treating his staff very poorly. McGinn's faults are well known enough that they inspired eight people to run against him. He has done some good things, but in the process, he almost always guarantees that the people who work with him will never work with him again. And that's, you know, that's one reason why a lot of environmentalists were unhappy with McGinn, this race, is because they have worked with him either on the Sierra Club or against the tunnel or in some other capacity during his time in the mayor's office. And he has just burned a lot of bridges.
The interesting thing, though, is as late votes were being counted, he was picking up a lot of votes towards the end there.
Yeah, he got a lot of the undecideds.
I think a lot of people were hoping that Steinbrück would get those votes. Why do you think that didn't happen?
A lot of the scuttlebutt behind Steinbrück is that he just ran a very bad campaign, that he wasn't a good manager. That's not a good sign in somebody who wants to be chief executive of a large city. And Peter is somebody that personally I like a great deal, and you know, some of his stances I'm not thrilled about, and others I like very much. But he ran a campaign. Several of the candidates in order to distinguish themselves in a crowded field shifted ideologically as the campaign went on. Steinbrück's shift was that he started appealing much more directly toward neighborhood voters and older voters in the North End, which makes a certain amount of sense because in a primary, that's where a primary skews. It skews older, it skews more conservative.
And I think he got a lot of donations probably from neighborhood activists in the North End.
The same way that Murray got a lot of the donations that he inherited when Burgess dropped out,
and he
became more conservative over the course of the campaign. That's why you saw when the kerfuffle over Whole Foods showed up, which was sheer opportunism on McGinn's part. This is a labor struggle and an attempt to organize that's been going on for 5 or 6 years, at least in the Seattle area, Whole Foods being a notorious anti-union company. And, McGinn picks a month before the primary as the time to make his very noisy stand, and got great support from the UFCW and other unions as a result of that. It was very calculated, and I doubt we're going to be hearing much more about McGinn's commitment to the workers' rights to organize.
Yeah.
But certainly not after November. But in the meantime, well, unless it's the police union, Hopefully we won't be hearing anything from him again after November, but that's another story. So Steinbrück was attempting to appeal to the older, more conservative primary voter, something like 75% of primary voters are north of Madison in Seattle, and a third of them are north of North 85th. It skews very heavily to the north end, older, mm-hmm. conservative, more white. And, you know, Steinbrück tried to exploit that, and he didn't do a very good job. His campaign was not well run. A number of people left at one point or another out of frustration, and it never really took off the way that people thought it would, because, you know, Steinbrück, in some ways is the most populist of the candidates, although, you know, McGinn can lay claim to that also with his support in the environmental community. And then Harrell also never really got out of the South End in terms of, his base of support. And I think his, I wouldn't even say waffling, his internal contradictions on his stance on police reform, I think, yeah. really hurt him.
Yeah, you know, we were talking before the show a little bit about some of the major issues that McGinn hasn't been addressing as mayor, you know, transportation, police reform and stuff. And do you think that really played against some of the candidates like Harrell and Steinbrück? I noticed Steinbrück didn't mention a whole lot about police reform during his campaign. He was talking a whole lot more about development issues and growth issues.
Yeah, I think none of the challenger candidates did a very good job of distinguishing themselves from each other or from McGinn. Mm-hmm. And this is a problem that you run into in Seattle, is because just about everybody that runs for higher office is a, you know, business-friendly liberal Democrat. And there's not a whole lot ideologically that distinguishes them. It's, you know, as opposed to, you know, a city like, you know, Dallas or Chicago or, you can have Republicans running for citywide office in a lot of major cities in this mm-hmm. country, and it just doesn't happen in Seattle. That being said, the other thing that was an issue is, in terms of the political class in the city and organizers in the city, it's very much an insider's club. And, you know, you don't get the platform and you don't get a fair hearing if you don't hew to a certain set of standards. And we saw that very much in this campaign. You know, there were five people in the race who never really got any media coverage. In the case of Charlie Stadecker, even though he had raised $200,000, he'd raised $150,000 by early May, I think. And he was never given a serious hearing because there were four people in the race who'd held previous elected office, who were getting all the attention and oxygen. The other aspect of that is it was a very misogynist race. I mean, there were three women candidates in the race. They were ridiculed and ignored by media, by organizers. Kate Martin, I mean, I saw this with Joey, the person I was working for, certainly close up, but I think Kate Martin had it even worse, where, you know, she's a neighborhood activist with a long history of civic engagement, and she had, you know,
she had good things to say.
She had good things to say. She had a plausible case for running for mayor, and she was in the race early, and she couldn't get the time of day. And you know, I can remember her like literally breaking down into tears, showing up at the city club, and they wouldn't let her on stage. Mm-hmm. And you know, some of the media coverage, and I'm going to particularly talk about the Seattle Times, when they had an early article talking about, here are the 10 people who are qualified to run for mayor, and there was not a single woman on the list. And the Stranger, which ran several just terrible articles, you know, ridiculing the women candidates in a way that they were not ridiculing any of the male candidates. Mm-hmm. You know, there's something, you know, and we have obviously women elected officials at pretty much every level of government around here, except that we have never had one running City Hall.
Yeah.
You know, that, I shouldn't say never. Seattle had a woman mayor in 1924, but not since then. Certainly not in the last generation has a woman even made a strong run for mayor. I mean, Jan Drago didn't do as well as she was thought to a few years back. Before that, I think Cheryl Chow tried and didn't do well one year. And those are people who are on city council.
Yeah, people with a lot of past experience.
You know, there's something about this insider's club that really cannot deal with the idea of a woman running things. And I hate to put it that bluntly, but there is, underneath our good liberal facade in Seattle, along with the very strong strain of racism that we see manifest in a number of ways, I think there's also a fair amount of misogyny. Mm-hmm. And it was very discouraging to see that close up.
Yeah, and just going back a little bit to some of those issues, I was talking about some of those issues that matter, like police reform and transportation and stuff. I think, in particular, that may be why Murray was so popular, because he distinguished himself from McGinn. He saw McGinn as his main challenger from the start.
Everyone did. Everyone was running against McGinn.
And yeah, and distinguished himself by saying, "Well, the first thing I'm going to do is if I get elected, I'm going to replace the chief of police." You know, something that McGinn has been stalling on and is not seen as a priority at all. And,
well, I think if McGinn's reelected, I think Puget will just become the permanent chief. It'll be another internal hire,
which is not the way to go.
Saying anything specific about Puget, because I think he actually is a more fair-minded guy than Diaz was. But you know, internal hires with a police force that has a corrupt culture from top to bottom, and I'm not talking about corrupt in terms of exchanging monies. I'm talking about corrupt in terms of its ability to deal fairly with the public and the trust that it engenders in the public.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is a culture that needs to be changed from top to bottom. And Mike McGinn has made it clear over and over and over again that he does not see that as a problem.
Yeah, yeah.
All right.
So some of the other races.
Yeah,
there
were other races. Again, disclaimer that I'm now working for and I have been consulting with her all along, but I think the biggest surprise of the election was how well Shama Sawant did. You know, this is an openly socialist candidate who, in terms of a major citywide race, probably did as well as any open socialist has done in a citywide race in a U.S. city, certainly since maybe Bobby Seale, I think, ran for office in Oakland in the late 60s and did quite well. Before that, you'd have to go back to, like, you know, pre-World War II. She is at 35% of the vote. She kept Conlon well under 50% running against Richard Conlon. And the third person in the race, Brian Carver, who's typical Seattle Democrat type who had, I think, $50,000 or $60,000. He had quite amount of money for the primary. She obliterated him, which is something unheard of for any kind of a third party candidate in our system. So she goes into a race against Conlon, and generally the rule of thumb is that if an incumbent gets less than 50%, and I believe Conlon is down to 47 with last night's latest election drops, they're considered vulnerable. Conlon, I think, in terms of the sort of establishment media in town, was not considered vulnerable, and people thought he would be getting 70% of the vote in the primary.
Yeah.
And a lot of people were very upset with him. So it's already quite remarkable, and I think, it's the first race we're going to see in Seattle in quite a while where there is a clear ideological contrast between the two candidates. Conlon is the most despite how he likes to portray himself, and I think the Stranger's election issue endorsement description of him as a greenwashing liberal fraud is really right on the mark. He is the most conservative, the most corrupt in terms of his willingness to do the bidding of all of his 700 maximum donation dollar developer friends. He is the most problematic of the city council members at this point. Even though he was elected 16 years ago as a progressive and as a green, he's been moving steadily to the right ever since. And he's as particularly terrible on social issues and particularly arrogant personally and professionally toward women, toward people of color, toward the poor, toward immigrants, and Shama is all of those. So,
yeah.
So it'll be very, very interesting to see how that race unfolds.
Yes.
So that was exciting. Mike O'Brien did comfortably well in a primary in his race against Albert Chen. As one of the two progressives on city council, and he's very much become his own person and more clearly progressive on a wider variety of issues rather than just the environmental platform he was originally elected on, and more clearly distinguishing himself from Mike McGinn. O'Brien is somebody who works well with people. And who's willing to listen on a variety of issues. And so he did well. That was exciting. And the Parks Levy got nearly 70% of the vote, which was great to see.
Which just proves that people will vote for higher taxes for things that they really do want to pay for.
Well, and once again, it shouldn't, as with many other things that we get levies for like this, you know, schools and parks and so forth. The governments have learned the trick of putting things that people know are essential, know need to be funded on the ballot where they'll vote yes. But at the same time, the things that are controversial, like, oh, say, stadiums or downtown tunnels or whatnot.
Yeah, there's no vote on those.
Yeah, exactly. Or the votes, as with the tunnel, happen after it's a fait accompli. So it was good to see that. The school board, one concern there, Sue Peters, who is, I think, a great candidate and probably one of the best people to run for school board in a couple of cycles now, running against Suzanne Dale Esty, who's a very well-funded charter school proponent. And Esty came out on top.
Well, but they're neck and neck.
They're neck and neck.
Which is good.
Which is good, but Peters has her work cut out for her, and I hope people will consider supporting her financially and otherwise, because she's going to get outspent badly, I think, by all the corporate interests trying to influence the school district.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Anything else? Otherwise?
No, I think we can move on.
Yeah, let's do that. So we've got an election in November now, so we'll have more chances to come back to these.
All right. City Council did do a couple things this week.
Yeah, and in terms of the election of November, one item of note for that, which is that the District's Initiative, an initiative to change the way we elect City Council members, to have seven of them elected by district around the city, and then two at large. Did qualify, and the council put it on the November ballot, so it'll be there side by side with the public financing initiative. And we'll talk about ways in which they're different, and in ways in which, in theory at least, they both ought to pass. In practice, the public financing has some concerns that we'll talk about as we get closer to the election. But good to see that those will both be on the ballot, and people will have a choice around that. So they turned in more than twice the number of signatures that were required. So it was pretty clear council had to act, and of course they chose to do it right the day before the primary, so it'll get the least amount of media attention, which is why I thought I'd mention it here.
So people in Seattle definitely are for some kind of election reform, it sounds like.
Yeah, we'll see.
All right. And developments this week with Representative Dave Reichert.
Yeah, our old friend Dave Reichert, Sheriff Dave, the man who bungled the Green River Killer, and then 20 years later when they finally caught him, stared him down. Man of great courage. Likes to portray himself, and his friends at the Seattle Times like to portray him as a conscience-driven independent. And, not so much. Particularly in the last few years, he's become more and more of a sort of regular Tea Party-type Republican. And we saw that again this week with Reichert being asked about the Congress's role in helping to resolve the conflict between federal and state law around marijuana legalization. Because now that pot is legal in the state of Washington, there are all kinds of conflicts with federal law, and not just the obvious one about, possession, but also things like, dispensaries that are having a hard time opening because they can't get banking, because federal banks are get threatened with asset seizure if they launder drug money, which, if you have a legitimate legal business, that's not considered a legal business by the federal government. So banks aren't willing to provide services to a lot of these new businesses.
Not even going to open a checking account for them.
No. So there are a lot of these kind of problems, and the logical place to resolve those is Congress. And so here's Representative Reichert on his role. I think it was a bad decision. He's referring there to the not a decision, but the vote of a solid majority of his state's and his district's voters. I think it's going to crumble here in the state of Washington. I'll be very clear. I am not going to assist the federal government in any way to find a solution to the conflict between state and federal law. I can't do it. Well, what Reichert is saying there is not that he can't do it. He's saying that he won't do it. And he won't do it not because there aren't solutions to be had, but because he disagrees with voters. I mean, that's what it comes down to, is that he's not willing to represent his constituents because he doesn't like the way they feel about something, which is really kind of a microcosm for how the entire Republican Party has operated in D.C. Because they didn't like the decision of voters to reelect President Obama. So, so the next time you hear Reichert being, being portrayed as some sort of, caring independent or moderate or whatever, just remember that he's basically doing the same kind of nonsense as the rest of his colleagues in the party in D.C. He'll be happy to represent you as long as you already agree with him. And if you don't, and in this case the majority of the citizens, even in his own district, do not, he doesn't care. He won't help you. That's our Republican Party for you.
Moving on, the Supreme Court ruling in terms of California prisons?
Yeah, the Supreme Court ruled this week for the second time, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that California must free at least 10,000 inmates from their overcrowded prisons. This was an appeal on an appeal of a Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals decision. The Supreme Court voted 6-3 that California must reduce its prison population to 110,000, which is, by the way, about 137% of the designed capacity of its prison facilities. And they have to do this by the end of the year. This, again, is an affirmation of an earlier ruling in 2011 made by the Supreme Court that found that California's prisons were overcrowded and that the conditions amounted to cruel and unusual punishment. And I just want to point out that currently hundreds of prisoners in California are still on a hunger strike to protest solitary confinement policies, overcrowding, and other abuses. And the hunger strike began last month with about 30,000 prisoners, and there's still at least 500 who are engaging in it. So that tells you something.
I think I actually started in June. It's been close to 2 months now.
Yeah.
But the other thing, just for context with that 110,000 prisoners that the Supreme Court wants California to reduce its prison population to, even that level per capita, if California were a separate country, would make it one of the highest rates of incarceration of any country in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Even reducing it from what it is now
to 110,000.
Yeah. So it just tells you, you know, how incarceration dependent our country has become. And again, going back to drug laws, that's a lot of it. An awful lot of prisoners in all of our states are in prison either because of drug related crime or because they're not nonviolent drug offenders.
Right.
All right. Also this week, President Obama doing round two of his tour.
Yeah, his economic tour. Last week I talked about Obama saying that he's tired of trying to pass immigration reform and gun control laws, and now he wants to work on his economic issues. This week he rolled out his second point on his platform. He gave a speech about the housing market. Well, It was most interesting about what he didn't say. He didn't say that he was going to talk about providing meaningful relief for homeowners who are underwater or who can't get banks to refinance their loans. He wasn't going to talk about giving bankruptcy court judges the ability to forgive housing debt. He wasn't going to talk about encouraging cities and counties to use eminent domain to seize abusive mortgages and write down inflated principal. No, Obama talked about doing away with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac now that the housing market has, quote unquote, recovered. In other words, this is a direct quote. He said, quote, "I believe that our housing system should operate where there's a limited government role, and private lending should be the backbone of the housing market," end quote.
As if
Fannie and Mae have done such a terrible job rescuing the housing market from the predation of private banks.
Yeah, that private system is exactly what got us into the soup in the first place, and their predation has continued.
Yeah.
And has continued without any particular objection from the Obama administration.
Yeah, and in the past 5 years since the housing market collapse.
Since
the housing market collapse, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac have underwritten or supported or backstopped about 87% of all new mortgage loans. That's for the last 5 years. So I think you could argue that since the housing market has slowly been making a sort of fitful recovery, that the last thing you would want to do is change things at this point. But no, not if you're President Obama. You know, he's a Demopublican, and he's going to do what he thinks big business wants him to do, and that's now that the government has rescued the housing market, he's going to give it back to private industry and let them ruin it all over again.
Yeah, the looting continues.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, speaking of continues, further revelations this week in regards to NSA surveillance.
Yes. The New York Times actually got on the bandwagon a little bit this week. They interviewed several intelligence officials, and they verified that the NSA, yes, it does sift all data that travels abroad, not just communications, to or from foreign persons. Now, you have to remember that a lot of communication between people in the U.S. often gets routed abroad because there are plenty of nodes in foreign countries that handle internet traffic when it slows down in on U.S. nodes. So that means it doesn't matter whether you're actually emailing somebody in a foreign country or visiting a foreign website. The NSA is looking at your stuff anyway. Now, I also want to say, too, that the NSA uses keywords to sift this data for communications, looking for any communications that are about a target, not just to a targeted individual. So if, for example, you type bin Laden in an email, this is going to get picked up and collected. Now, what I thought was very interesting about this New York Times article was one senior intelligence official helpfully pointed out that this NSA procedure of sifting information about a target is not just used for terrorism investigations. Now, he didn't say what other types of investigations they were used for, but you can imagine, you know, you could be typing about anything. Drugs, weapons, money, sex. I mean,
not liking the government.
Yeah. So there are really no limits to what the NSA can look at and read and collect, what he was saying.
And refer to law enforcement.
Yeah. Actually, it also came out this week that the NSA is feeding that information over to the DEA
and the
IRS, and then telling them to cover up where it came from.
Yes, so that, to other agencies. Yeah, other agencies are involved in this. And in fact, the other agencies are complaining, well, you know, the NSA doesn't give us all the information we want. And you just like, and you hear that, and I'm just like, well, the fact that they're giving you any of this stuff makes me nervous.
The fact they have it in the first place makes me nervous.
Yeah.
So, anything else on that?
A little bit more. Glenn Greenwald wrote for The Guardian this week, too, that members of Congress are routinely denied information about these NSA surveillance programs that need to know, I guess, excludes everyone in Congress who's not on the intelligence subcommittees. And then he helpfully pointed out that intelligence subcommittee members received hefty contributions from defense and surveillance corporations, especially the two committee chairs, Dianne Feinstein in the Senate and Republican Mike Rogers in the House.
Yep. And I'll just add on a couple things related to NSA, since I know we're running out of time.
Mm-hmm.
The first is that the whole dust up over Snowden being granted temporary asylum in Russia, and the terrible, terrible media coverage of that in the United States. I mean, it would take something like U.S. media to make what Russia did sound unreasonable.
And
by contrast, you know, if a Russian whistleblower just kind of showed up out of the blue at JFK Airport in New York, there's no way on earth the United States would hand him back. But that's without the factor that Russia had, that Russia doesn't extradite people facing the death penalty to countries with the death penalty, because most of the world considers what the U.S. does in terms of the death penalty barbaric to begin with. Most of the world considers this kind of persecution of a whistleblower barbaric as well. And then you have, you have United States hypocrisy around extradition policy. So it's all all very concerning. So there's that. And then you also had this week with the embassies shutting down around supposed intelligence from the NSA. First, there's no evidence that intelligence actually came from the NSA. But it was also interesting that this came on the 12th anniversary of a certain intelligence warning about a possible terrorism attack. That was the famous Bin Laden determined to strike in U.S. article that the briefing that the Bush administration completely ignored. And that's why we have NSA abuses today.
Events.
Yeah. One to talk about, which is that Ground Zero is doing its annual weekend around the anniversary of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, yesterday being the anniversary of Nagasaki. So at 1 o'clock today, actually at 1:30, people will be meeting at the going to the main gate. I believe they're convening up the road at 1 o'clock. Mm-hmm. That over in Kitsap County, outside the Bangor Nuclear Subbase on Clear Creek Road in Paulsbo, and you can go to their website at gzcenter.org for all the details.
All right. Talking as we do every week with John Parrish and Maria Tomchick, both with Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org.